Welcome back to Stacktrace, the show that is all about life and technology from two developers' perspective. And those two developers are both me, John Sundell, and my good friend from across the Atlantic, Mr. Guy Rambo. How's it going, Rambo?
Hi, John. Doing great here.
Excellent. So before we kick off the show today, we actually have a little bit of a favor to ask of you, our dear listeners. And no, it's not going to be like and subscribe and that whole thing, you know, that people always tell you. But we have something that we think is going to be fun and also that you could help us out a little bit with. Because as you might have heard, podcast listening overall, like in the whole podcast industry, has been quite affected by the current situation because it turns out that when people are not commuting, they're not listening as much to podcasts. And we could really use your help in just like spreading the word a little bit extra about our show. So if you like Stacktrace and if you're listening to it, you probably like it, at least, you know, to some extent, then we could really use your help in just sharing the show. Like either share it with a friend, share it on Twitter, like help us spread the word about the show. Because we realize this might sound a little bit absurd because, you know, we have quite a lot of followers on Twitter and we have websites where we can post about this stuff, but nothing beats like a personal recommendation from a friend. So if you could help us out, that would be really awesome. And the thing we have here for you, we're doing a little bit of growth hacking here, as the kids call it, right, Rambo?
Yeah.
So we thought about a fun little like incentive, if you will, to help us out here and to make it a little bit of a fun little game. So if you could help us out by tweeting anything about Stacktrace, like a link to an episode or recommendation about the show or what you like about it, it could be anything you want, but use the hashtag #ShareStacktrace. So not ask Stacktrace, but share Stacktrace. And what we'll do is that we'll pick a winner from everyone who has shared using that hashtag. And the winner will win a 1-hour mentorship session with me and Rambo. So you'll get a 1 hour to talk about code with us or talk about anything you'd like. And yeah, I think that's going to be a lot of fun. What do you think, Rambo?
Yeah, I think that sounds like a lot of fun. And if you are the winner, like John mentioned, you're going to be able to ask us questions and we can do like mentorship about coding or coding interviews or maybe career, or if you want to launch your app, we can give you marketing advice. I think we can help you out in many ways, so definitely participate in this campaign. I think the winner is going to get a lot out of it, and I think we are going to as well.
Yeah, we really wanted to set something up where it feels like a win-win, right? Because we know that every podcast asks you to, you know, rate them and share them and these kind of things. And, it can get a little bit tiring to always hear that. But we really, really need your help. And we will do this little lottery. And, you know, if it goes well, then maybe we'll do another one and see how it goes from there. So again, share the show if you want to with the hashtag #ShareStacktrace. And we'll pick a winner from there.
Awesome.
But with that, let's kick off the show. What have you been up to, Rambo?
So I've been dusting off an old project of mine. People might not think of it as old, but it is old to me. And you always have these projects that you work on from time to time, and they are in a state where they are established and they have a code base that has a lot of old stuff in it. So every time you want to work on it, you kind of have to get to know the code base again. And I'm doing that for the unofficial WWDC app for macOS.
Awesome. And if I remember correctly, because you've told me about the kind of work that you usually need to do on a yearly basis when it comes to this app, and it's usually that Apple keeps changing their JSON format, right? For getting the streams. And is there anything else that you need to do, or is it just like ongoing maintenance?
It's like you mentioned, every year there are some changes Apple does. They also introduce new stuff to their own app that we sometimes like to include in the unofficial version. And like yesterday, I was working on integrating with the new transcription thing that they have in their app, because it used to be that we used ASCII WWDC by Matt for the transcripts because Apple didn't offer a built-in transcription thing for the sessions. They offered subtitles in the videos, but that was it. So now Apple does have an API of their own with the transcripts, so we're using that. And what's cool about it is that it even has transcripts in Chinese, Japanese, Korean, and one more language, which I don't remember, besides English. So yeah, it's a really cool that we've been able to integrate that in, and that's the work I did yesterday. And like you mentioned, there's also the API changes that happen almost every year to some extent. I remember there was one year where they completely changed the API and we had to scramble to fix it in like 2 days or something. But yeah, it's always keeping up with what's new in the Apple side of things. And what keeps this project going really is people using it. So I know there are a lot of people who use it and rely on the app. And yeah, I'd like to make sure those people can still use it. And I am one of those people, so I have extra motivation.
I am one of those people too. In fact, I used the app, I think, 2 days ago. Yeah. I was rewatching an old WWDC session. And that's the great thing about it, is that you just have this one destination on your computer, a native app where you can just search for any WWDC video, and with the transcripts and everything. It's really like a really nice complete package when it comes to all of that knowledge that, for better and for worse, is only in WWDC sessions, right? There is so much, especially with the latest technologies from Apple, where there is no documentation on the in the documentation in Xcode, or you know, if you search for it, but there's a ton of content and information in WWDC sessions. In fact, when I wrote my latest article about Xcode previews, I went back and watched the session about that from WWDC, and it was just a great reminder and a great source of stuff you can do with that API that is just not really documented elsewhere. Except for now, when I've documented it, which is great.
Yeah, that's true. And then that's why I do it as well. I was doing some stuff with CoreML recently, and I also played around with the new multiple window stuff on iPad. So I went back to WWDC, and I really like having it on my Mac so I can like open Xcode and do stuff side by side. And I can also add bookmarks, which is a feature that I developed that I really love, that you can bookmark specific points in the video and add little comments for yourself. Because there are many times when you're watching a WWDC video and there's like a specific slide or specific thing the presenter said that you know is going to be important when you actually go and implement that stuff. So you can add a bookmark and put a comment. So yeah, I think it's a really great learning resource, so I am keeping it up. And yeah, like I mentioned, it's an old app, like it's been around since 2015, I think, maybe before that. So it's
yeah, it's like ancient history in terms of apps.
Yeah, like the first version was in Swift 1, I think. Like it was, yeah, it is quite an old app. And we rewrote it pretty much from the ground up with version 6, which was released, I think, in 2016 or 2017. But there's still quite a bit of old stuff in there. And it is quite complicated. It sounds like a simple app, like it's just a list of videos. But if you look into the data model for the app and how complex it is, like the biggest complexity is just how big the data model is, because there are many, many, many sessions with transcripts. So, and all of that has to be searchable in real time in the app. So there's quite a bit of work that goes into keeping that functional.
Right, because you can't just make a new request every time someone like types a character in the search field, right? Like you need to have that offline layer and that kind of caching on the client side. And once you add that, like if you have a model where you can always just make a new request and you get a response back and you render that response and you're done, That's a pretty simple model, right? Like, you can keep things pretty straightforward and pretty simple that way, but once you add that client state, like whatever it is, like some kind of offline mode or that the users can enter things on the client side and then that gets synced later to the server, like that just adds like an order of magnitude of complexity when you have to add those layers, which most apps need to do, you know, one way or another or at one point or another.
Yeah, definitely. And so we have basically two layers of syncing because we sync with Apple's API and we also sync over CloudKit for user data such as bookmarks and progress in videos and favorites and things like that. So I guess you could also call a third layer of syncing, which is the file system, because when you download sessions, so you can download videos, we chose to keep the source of truth for that on the file system. So if you delete a video from the place where you set to download the videos, it's going to reflect that state in the app. And that's also another layer of syncing that has to go on. So yeah, it's complicated, but the good thing is that most of it is in there and it's implemented in a way that if there are changes to the underlying models, we can massage them into what the app expects. So I think we're good to go.
Yeah, having some kind of translation or adaptation layer is probably really crucial in this case, right? Because you're not using like an official API that is documented, that has all the bells and whistles, or versioning and backwards compatibility. It's like an API that you're maybe not really supposed to be calling from the outside.
Yeah, and to be clear, I'm really glad that Apple never, like, they never tried to shut down the app in any way, which I guess if they wanted to, they could. Like, they could not like the fact that it's using the API of the official app. But I heard some birdies that there are some people there who actually like and use the app. So I think we're good in that front.
Yeah, because it provides a ton of utility for the community, right? And you're not monetizing it in any way. Like, you're really doing it as just a favor to the community, really. Like, there's very little things that you have to gain from it other than that you get this app yourself, which is a great thing, and that it's probably pretty fun to work on it.
Yeah, the major reason why I wrote the app was for myself. Like, I wanted this app. So yeah,
that's a great reason to write an app. Like, that's why I write most of my tools. And you know, that's it comes from a desire to solve a problem for yourself, which is always something that is easier to motivate yourself around rather than solving a hypothetical problem or solving someone else's problem. It's always solving your own problems is a very good motivator.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's what I've been doing. And also on the procrastinating side of things, I decided that I really wanted the macOS emoji picker on iPadOS. So I wrote my own as well.
Speaking of solving your own problems, right? You couldn't wait until WWDC, where we're going to play our poker, so I don't want to tilt my hand too much here, but I think it's fair to say that having a system-wide emoji picker is definitely something that could happen for iPadOS 14. But you just couldn't wait those couple of weeks. You just had to build it yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's what I did for procrastinating this week. But I want to hear about you, John. What have you been up to?
So I've been doing a bunch of coding lately. It's been really great to get back into coding because sometimes, you know, I have weeks where I do a lot of just like writing and podcast editing and recording with people and making videos and these kinds of things. And I love doing that too. But it's also really great to sometimes have a couple of days where you can just sit down and write code like the good old days back when I was quote unquote just a developer, right? When I didn't do all of these other things. So it's been really great. Just in the last, I would say, 48 hours, I have been coding in, let's see if I can remember, Swift, CSS, Haskell, Rust, JavaScript, and PHP.
Wow.
Yep. So it's kind of funny because I think that a lot of people, they see me as this, you know, Swift guy, right? Like this guy who loves Swift, uses Swift for everything, you know, whether it's web development or scripting or app development, it's all in Swift. And I do love Swift. I think Swift really strikes a nice middle ground between a lot of different like features and kind of extremes when it comes to programming languages. So it strikes a nice balance between being really fast, you know, at runtime, the compiler could still use a little bit of a speed up here and there, I think. Yeah. But the runtime speed is incredibly fast because it's native. You have modern syntax, you have a really strong type system. You know, you have all these nice things kind of baked into one language. So I do really love Swift, but just because I do and because I write about it, like I don't write about all these other languages. I don't write about Rust or Haskell or JavaScript or PHP. I use all these languages anyway because they all have different kind of trade-offs that they make and they are good for different circumstances. And sometimes that's based on the environment that, you know, this environment has first-class support for JavaScript. One of those examples would be Cloudflare, right? Mm-hmm. When I'm building like Cloudflare Cloud Functions, their API is primarily in JavaScript. So then I don't want to fight the system and use something else. I just use what's there. And when I write some custom backends, I love to use PHP for that because that's my kind of go-to language that I've been using for backend web development for decades now. So it all kind of depends on my environment. And I love the fact also that I get to use so many different programming languages kind of on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, definitely. I'm the same. Like I write quite a bit of JavaScript because my backends are usually using Node.js these days. I am like yourself, a PHP veteran. Like I used PHP for a really long time, but I kind of fell in love with the Node.js way of doing things. So I managed to become fairly productive in that environment. So that's what I usually do when I need to write some backend for something. But yeah, you have the language you love, of course, but that doesn't mean you have to use it for absolutely everything.
Exactly. And it's fun sometimes to kind of quote unquote push Swift to its limits, right? Or to try Swift in a new context. That is also fun for me and interesting from a kind of, you know, exploration standpoint. But sometimes I just want to get something done. And for today, for example, I was writing a backend service and I just needed to like open a file, parse some JSON, write some logic, and then output some HTML. And for me, like I can get that done in PHP in like really, really quickly. Like, because I know how to do it. I've done it so many times before and it almost feels like second nature. While if I had to like spin up a, you know, either like a Node instance or a Swift server or something else, and then, you know, write all these routes and getters and async functions and all that stuff. I'm not saying that's bad. Those things are way more powerful and they definitely have use cases as well. But if I just need to like open a file, do some logic, output the results, like that I will do in PHP, or if I would know like Python or Ruby or any of the languages that are in the similar kind of vein as PHP in that sense, I just use that because, you know, it's what makes me the most productive.
Yeah, exactly. It's what you're used to. And like you mentioned, it's not because something is bad. And I think in our deep dive this week, we're going to talk about that when it comes to AppKit, because many people have this impression that AppKit is bad, when in fact the only thing wrong with it is that they don't have experience with it. So yeah, it's common for people to feel like a technology isn't good just because they're new and they don't understand it. But going back to the performance thing about Swift, that's like one of my favorite things about Swift lately, because I've been working on AirBuddy 2.0 for a while and I was doing some benchmarking recently and it's so fast. Like I look at my CPU graph and my memory usage graph and I know that there's like a lot of stuff going on and nothing, like it doesn't even register. It's amazing how fast it is. And of course, you have to do things in the right way and use the correct constructs for that. But I think it makes it quite easy to make things be performant.
It really does. And there are so many benefits to writing really, really ridiculously fast software. Mm-hmm. Like sometimes it can feel a little bit like a, you know, academic exercise, or it can feel a little bit redundant to like spend so much time making something fast. And like you say, like Swift Even though there are ways to write inefficient Swift code too, of course, but it kind of gives you that advantage of having that really fast, native, and also really highly optimized in many cases code that you get out of the compiler. But even going to that extra length and making your algorithms and your rendering code and everything that you write fast as well, it has so many benefits because not only do you get a fast product, but one thing also that I've been really appreciating myself lately is fast turnaround speeds. So as an example, I was doing some benchmarking myself as well, and I shared some of it on Twitter, that when I do test-driven development on some of my projects, like some of my libraries, especially like Ink, my Markdown parser, or Splash, my syntax highlighter, which I usually do TDD in those contexts, like test-driven development, because it's a great fit where if you want to add a new feature, like if for Splash, for example, if you want to highlight some new Swift feature or fix syntax highlighting if it's wrong in some place, it's really nice to do TDD because you put in a test what is currently failing and you put what you're expecting it to be, and then you just work your way there. And I mean, I'm not going to say that, you know, my code is the fastest code ever written, but I, since I cared a lot about speed when I wrote these things, I really tried to architect them as well as I could to be as fast as I could make them. It just makes it so easy to have that kind of workflow where I could run the entire test suite, which is like over 100 tests, in like 0.1 seconds, you know, which just makes the turnaround times instant. So I can just try something, try it again, recompile the test, run them, you know, 0.1 seconds later, I have the result, I can keep going. So it's fast software is just wonderful.
Absolutely. Yeah, I definitely agree. And speaking about fast software, John, you've been using FusionCast.
Nice segue. That was very good. That's right. And not only have I been using your fast software, I've also been producing things really quickly as well. So there you go. It's all fast all around.
Nice.
Yeah, so I don't want to spend too much time on this, but it's just an interesting thing. I think I talked to you on a couple of episodes ago that I wanted to use your new app to actually create things, right? Because your app, FusionCast, is primarily made for people who want to take a podcast episode like this one, turn it into a video, and then upload it somewhere, right? Like to YouTube or some other service. But I, of course, you know, I love to use tools in non-conventional ways. Like I love to try to do different things. And also, like I mentioned earlier, I love constraints. I love when I can use something that is a little bit more simple and produce something out of it. So I wanted to use FusionCast to create what I call a micro podcast, which is essentially that I have an idea. I want to share something, but it's not so long that I want to write an article about it. And it's not so long either that I can have like a podcast, like a proper podcast conversation about it, like with you or on Swift by Sindel. And it's also not so short that I can fit into a tweet. So where does that go? So I had this idea that I will use FusionCast. I will create this like 2 minute super tiny podcast that I can just record super quickly, edit it, and get it out in like 20 minutes in total, and use FusionCast to generate a video from that audio with some code samples and then put that on Twitter. So it's like a micro podcast. I guess it's not technically a podcast, but a micro audio file with a code sample on Twitter. That's what it is. So I've been doing that twice now, and the response has been pretty nice. So I think I'm going to keep doing it.
Yeah, I really like them. And being short means that it's low effort, even for those who are watching it. Like, you just click play on Twitter and watch the video. And there's a feature of FusionCast that's coming up in the future that's going to be really useful, I think, because FusionCast is going to support MP3 and whatever audio format you're using, chapters in the future. And I told you I was going to prioritize that feature, so I am going to prioritize that. Many people have been asking for that. So you're going to be able to have like mini slideshows. So you can create an audio file with chapters, and it's each chapter, it's going to have its own chapter art for that particular quote slide. And it's going to switch between them.
Awesome. Looking forward to it. Because one thing that I really wanted to do here was to kind of have a sense of immediacy, you know, both from my perspective. Like, I have this idea, I want to get it out there. I don't want to spend like a ton of time producing like a proper video like I have on my YouTube channel, because those take like a whole day to produce, like from the morning till the evening, a whole day, a whole working day to produce those. I don't want this for this. I want this to be, I come up with something, I want to share it, I can put it out there. And like you say, people can also listen to it in like 2 minutes and then it's done. Like, so it can just be something that pops up in their feed. They can just listen to it super quickly and then move on with their day. So I think it's a fun experiment. We'll see where it goes. And I'm looking forward to that chapter art feature.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm prioritizing. There's a John tag on my issue control system.
That's awesome. I appreciate it. Speaking of chapters, another great segue coming up here. Let's move on to our next chapter of this show. But before we do, let's take a very quick break and thank this episode's first sponsor. This week's episode of Stack Trace is brought to you by Concepts. Concepts is an app for iPhone and iPad that lets you sketch ideas, create mind maps, design layouts, and communicate visually on an infinite canvas. You can draw with fluid, pressure-sensitive brushes using designer colors that make sketches look professional, and using Concepts Vector Ink, you can move ideas around the canvas for brainstorming, iterate on and explore designs efficiently, and enjoy endless editability of your work. For example, you can use Concepts to visualize your thinking, to plan a project, or to whiteboard with clients and teammates using the app's automatic presentation mode. Simply pair it with virtual conferencing clients like Zoom or Reflector for easy virtual whiteboarding. There are also precision tools like grids, line and shape guides, and real-world measurements that make design work simple. And you can drag and drop images, vector graphics, PDFs, and other assets straight onto your canvas for fast concept work and drawing. Then you can deliver your best ideas in flexible formats, including PDF and SVG, and work seamlessly with other powerful creation apps like AutoCAD and Adobe's Creative Cloud. Try the Concepts app for free by downloading it from the App Store, and we'll also leave a link in the show notes to let you do that super quickly. Thanks a lot to the team behind Concepts for sponsoring this week's episode of Stack Trace. All right, Rambo. So now it's time for our In the News segment, where we discuss a news story from the past week. So what do you have for us?
So there have been rumors about a completely wireless iPhone for a while now, with some speculating that we might see a completely partless iPhone by 2022. And this discussion was brought up again this week. There's a piece by Ben Lovejoy on 9to5, which we're going to link to. And he talks about some possible drawbacks and advantages of the system. And I want to talk to you about that because there's been a lot of talk since at least last year about Apple moving to USB-C on the iPhone. And the first thing I want to ask you and answer here is, do you think we'll ever see a USB-C iPhone? Or do you think it will go completely wireless before that happens?
I think it's a really high possibility that we won't see a USB-C iPhone, because it kind of feels like, why go to another port if they are already planning to go to a portless design, right?
Yeah.
Because USB-C might be like a semi-standard. I mean, it is a standard, but you know, in terms of adoption, in terms of what people have in their homes and what's out there in the wild, USB-C is not really as ubiquitous as you might think, right? Like, if you are a heavy Apple user and you have like a MacBook Pro and an iPad Pro and all of the good stuff, then you have USB-C pretty much everywhere. But if you look at the larger world, I mean, there are Android devices that have USB-C, etc. But USB-C is not really like, hasn't really taken over the world, if you will. USB-A is still so common. So moving to USB-C will be quite disruptive. Like, people have to get new chargers and accessories and all sorts of stuff. So if they already are planning to go portless, then why, you know, go through that big of a mess when you can just skip that and go directly to portless.
Yeah, I think USB-A has been around since, I don't know, the 90s or something. So,
or maybe even earlier.
Yeah, so it's going to take a really long time for USB-C to become, in fact, a standard in the sense that it is everywhere like USB-A is. So it's very ubiquitous, USB-A. So I think you're right that USB-C is not something that you see around everywhere. I mean, you see it in my apartment, I guess yours as well, your house, because we have Apple stuff and we use Apple's new products. But yeah, definitely, especially if you're in a household that has devices from many different manufacturers, USB-C is not the standard. And assuming the 2022 timeline is correct, that by 2022 we would see an iPhone with no ports whatsoever, it really doesn't make sense to switch. It wouldn't have made sense to switch last year even, because like, why switch for 3 years or 2 years? It's not something. Imagine the amount of work that it would take to switch to this new port, both by Apple and by accessory developers and users that will have to buy new adapters and things like that just to use it for 1 or 2 years. It doesn't really make sense.
Exactly. I think one good indication of the work that USB-C still has to do in terms of adoption is, you mentioned that, you know, people like me and you and others who are like tech savvy, if you will, or like have a lot of different, you know, Apple products and things like that, we have a lot of USB-C devices. But even I bought a wireless charger from IKEA a few like days ago, and it came with USB-C on it. And I was surprised. Like, I was positively surprised. I was like, oh, it's USB-C. That's interesting. That's the level it's at, right? When you get a device, which is not an Apple device, and it has USB-C, you're surprised. At least I am. So yeah, it has some way to go. So yeah, I think we agree on this. I think it doesn't really make any sense right now. And, you know, Lightning, compared to USB-C, there are advantages, of course, of USB-C, and it's nice to have like the same port on all the different devices and so on. But Lightning is not like something that is holding the iPhone back, or do you think so?
No, I don't agree. Yeah, I don't think it's holding it back.
So one big question about the whole portless rumor, and you know, this has been speculated about before, but I think it would be interesting to talk about it now with this like rumor in mind, is what would things like development and debugging and, you know, diagnostics and things, like how would those things work if you don't have a port?
You know, I am a very positive person and I try to be optimistic about things, but this really scares me.
Yeah, it's like your spelunking gateway is being removed.
Not just because of that, but if you've done any Apple Watch development, you know that it's not very practical to do it on a real device. I'm sure our friends who do a lot of Apple Watch development would be able to give us some tips on how to do it better, or maybe they will just tell us that they use the simulator all the time. But it is very slow and very error prone. Like, it fails for me. Whenever I do Apple Watch development and I try to do it on device, it fails a lot. But it's, I think it is a little bit different from the iPhone, because when you are deploying to the Apple Watch, you're actually going through the iPhone. So you're depending on the connection between your computer and the iPhone, and the iPhone and the Apple Watch being perfect for it to be perfect. So I guess that's also why it's quite slow and error prone. So Wi-Fi development on Xcode has been around, I think, since version 10, right? It was there before in some beta a while back, but they ended up not shipping it. But I think it's since Xcode 10.
Yeah, it's definitely a recent version of Xcode where it's become at least reliable enough as well. Because in the first couple of iterations, it was like most new technologies, it was a little bit unreliable. But Wi-Fi based iOS development is like you've said, it's getting better. And even though it doesn't beat having that wired connection, it's also very practical.
Yeah, absolutely. I think they introduced it on the same year they introduced ARKit. it was like one of the reasons why they released it was, well, if you're going to be doing AR stuff and you want to walk around with your device, then it doesn't make sense to have a wire plugged into it.
Right.
And it is very practical. Whenever I do any AR stuff, which I don't do much of, but I have been doing some stuff with my new iPad with the LiDAR stuff, and I always use it with the Wi-Fi stuff. And it has gotten better than it used to be. Like, it works almost every time. And it is not like super slow, like deploying to the Apple Watch, but it's still not as fast as using a cable. So if you have an app, like for instance, Chibi Studio, it's not a super large app, but it's a relatively large app. It has a lot of assets. So if I change like the inventory asset catalog in Chibi Studio, it has like 80 megabytes or something. So the entire app that has to be copied to the device is like 120 or something. It takes a while. Like, it can take several seconds for the app to transfer over when I press Command R to run from Xcode. And that's not very good when you're trying to iterate. So,
right.
Yeah, I think there will have to be some sort of solution for that. And the Apple Watch has this hidden debugging part on it. It's behind one of the grooves where you put your watch band.
It's like one of those puzzle boxes that you have to solve, where you have to, like, you know, unscrew something and tilt it in one way, and then that hidden port gets revealed.
Yeah, exactly. But Apple has never offered such a cable for developers. And I presume, I don't know this for a fact, but I presume that at Apple, they use those cables for Apple Watch development. Like, they probably plug the Apple Watch into the Mac and use that special dock for development. I don't believe Apple engineers who work on the Apple Watch are using wireless development. I have a hard time believing that.
The Apple Watch is such an unfair development platform. Like, Apple uses UIKit, they use the special cable. Like, it's like a different world. I mean, if we make some presumptions here, but like you say, I also find it very hard to believe that they are using the current tools to build all of the built-in apps, because, well, They're not perfect. Let's just leave it at that.
Yeah, so one solution for that will be, and I really think that Apple should offer, like, sell it for $100 or something, the Apple Watch cable for registered developers. And I think if it comes to the same with the iPhone, I also think there should be some hidden part in there that's only for development, and that they would offer the whatever device you need to connect it to a Mac to developers. And if you don't want to, you don't have to get the device, you can use the wireless things. But more like, quote, serious developers who have larger apps and have to iterate more quickly, or that can test on the simulator reliably, they would just buy one of those cables.
Yeah, so that would be an interesting idea. But there's also a middle ground between a cable, like a traditional cable, and a completely wireless connection. And that's something like the smart connector, which is magnetic, right?
Mm-hmm.
And on the iPad, for example, I realized that maybe it doesn't have the same amount of bandwidth that something like a Lightning port or USB-C port has. But the smart connector on the iPad works really, really well for the different use cases that are there. And I'm just thinking that if you take that idea and kind of run with it, you could imagine, like, because Apple, they really love magnets, right? Like, magnets is in everything they make.
Yeah.
And they make magical things. Like, the way they use magnets, like in the iPad Pro to align the keyboard, and like in the new fancy display that I forgot the name of. What is it called? The new super expensive display? The XDR display,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
They use magnets everywhere. And it would be super cool with something like that is maybe not like a traditional cable where you plug it into a slot, but imagine that there's like a surface on the side of the iPhone, especially if we think about the iPhone being having the iPad Pro design language where it has these like sharper edges. Imagine there's a spot where you can just like connect a magnetic cable and it would just work as a standard cable. That would be pretty cool.
Well, there are rumors that the iPhone is going to get Apple Pencil support, and in some of the supposedly leaked CAD drawings for this year's iPhone, there was a little slot on the side that looked suspiciously close to the one on the iPad where you attach the Apple Pencil to. I think its code name is Scorpius, and yeah, I think it also transmits data. It's not just wireless charging. So
yeah, because it does things like pair with the Apple Pencil. Like when you first buy an Apple Pencil and you just put it there on the iPad and connect it with the magnet, it automatically pairs. So there is some kind of data transfer going on there.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think even Qi charging can transmit some data. Like they were going to use it for air power, where they can communicate between the charger and devices using, like, piggybacking on the magnetic stuff that's going on. I don't know anything about wireless charging. So it's the magnetic stuff.
Yeah. The magnetic mumbo jumbo.
Exactly.
Yeah, but there is a bunch of different things here, and it just feels like this is something that I feel like Apple, this is like Apple at their best, right? When they make these magnet-based solutions, and when there is this thing where you can just snap your pencil onto the iPad and it automatically connects and works with the Magic Keyboard, all of these different things, I just feel like that's in their wheelhouse to build something like this, like to build some form of connector that is still a cable, still has some form of like higher bandwidth than what a truly wireless connection would have, still gives you all those benefits, but it's still like it doesn't have any actual ports on the outside.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Cool. So after this fun amount of speculation, let's go ahead now and move into our deep dive for this episode, which is going to be all about Mac development. But before we do that, let's take another quick break and thank this episode's second and final sponsor. This week's episode of Stack Trace is also brought to you by CiroSSL. CiroSSL is a new, completely free and trusted certificate authority for SSL, aiming to make it easy and extremely affordable to create SSL certificates. It lets you get an SSL certificate for your API or website, which in turn lets you offer it over encrypted HTTPS traffic through an easy-to-use UI and API. Unlike other services like it, CiroSSL provides an easy-to-use API that allows users to create both 90-day and 1-year validity certificates through an unprecedentedly easy and simple process, so that you can write scripts and automation to issue your certificates whenever you need them. CiroSSL also offers both single domain and multi-domain and wildcard certificates for free through the standard ACME protocol, and allows users to create 1-year certificates with an affordable subscription plan. And they've also got that REST API that I just mentioned as well. And unlike some of their competitors, CiroSSL also enables users to validate domain ownership via email, not just DNS, which makes it much easier and quicker to issue certificates via their web UI. Try CiroSSL for your website or web API by going to ZeroSSL.com, and we'll also leave a link in the show notes as well. Thanks a lot to ZeroSSL for sponsoring this episode of Stack Trace. All right, Rambo. So for this week's deep dive, we kind of wanted to do a extension on the discussion from last week. So on last week's episode, we talked about the responder chain, and we talked about how the Mac and iOS kind of differs when it comes to how they use the responder chain, like to what extent that it really is kind of baked into the overall architecture of the system. And I think that it would be fun to follow that up with just an overall discussion and deep dive into Mac development, because I feel like there's a lot of developers out there, and we've talked about this on the show as well, who want to build some kind of tools for themselves. Like they want to build some kind of like app to help them automate some of their work, or maybe to have some kind of, you know, content management system app in their team or something else. Or maybe they just want to build like a product, like an app to actually ship to customers. But there's always been this kind of awkward gap between iOS and the Mac, where a lot of iOS developers, like you alluded to earlier, they feel like the Mac either feels like, you know, old, like the developer tools feel really old and the APIs are outdated, or it feels so different, it feels so kind of intimidating or hard to get started. So let's try to do something about that here on Stack Trace. So to kick things off, do you maybe just want to give us like an overview of the anatomy of a Mac app? Like, how does a Mac app differ from an iOS app from kind of a high-level architectural point of view?
Sure. So the first thing to consider is that if you are an iOS developer, and especially if you want to bring your iOS app to the Mac, there's, of course, Catalyst. And that's definitely a good option, especially if you don't want to maintain a lot of separation between platforms, which means more code, of course. So if you already have an iOS app and you want to bring it to the Mac, consider using Catalyst. But everything we're going to say after this point can also apply to Catalyst apps, because on Catalyst apps, it's not something that's official yet, but Apple doesn't have a problem with you doing it like that, but you can use AppKit on your Catalyst apps with some tricks. So it's important that you at least know the environment you're working with.
Yeah, because when you just check that checkbox in Xcode to bring your iOS app to the Mac, you essentially get just a window with an iOS simulator, for the lack of a better word, inside of it, right?
Basically.
And then you can do a lot of work to make it feel more Mac-like. You can, you know, like you say, you can bridge the gap between Catalyst and AppKit. You can throw some Swift UI in there if you want to really use all the technologies. but you can also do a lot of things inside of your window Chrome to actually like make the app feel really nice on the Mac. So yeah, all of these different technologies have their own kind of, you know, pros and cons. And like you're also saying, there's also a lot of value, I think, in even learning something about AppKit, even though there are these other technologies available.
Yeah, so going back to if you want to work with AppKit, you have to know what a Mac app looks like from the inside. So this is kind of funny, and it's kind of thrown around as a joke, but there's a lot of stuff in AppKit where if you take the UI kit version and replace UI by NS, it pretty much does the same thing. There are notable exceptions like that look almost the same from the outside, but are very different. I think the biggest one is UI image and NS image. They are super similar. The APIs are very similar, but they are completely different. Like, they have nothing to do with one another. The only thing they have in common is the API and the fact that they both can represent images, but I'm not going to go into detail now. So as with UIKit, you have your UI application. On AppKit, you have, guess what? NS application. Who would have thought? So you have your NS application. It can have multiple windows. There's actually a property on NS application called windows. And there are several different types of Mac apps, and they usually dictate a little bit about how your windows are managed. So the main two types of macOS apps, I think there are three like official types. They are shoebox apps, document-based apps, and utility apps. So I'm going to give some examples, and I think it's going to be easier to figure out the difference between them. So an example of a document-based app would be the Pages app or Text Edit. An example of a utility app would be the Calculator. And an example of a shoebox app would be the Music app, for instance, or the old iTunes. So basically, a document-based app is the type of app where you can have multiple documents opened at the same time, and you press Command N on your keyboard and it creates a new empty document for you to work with. A shoebox app manages its own documents. So like the MyWWDC app is also a shoebox app. You don't like save files and open a new document. You just open and it has a window and it manages its own content for you. And a utility app is an app that you open, do something, and close the window, and it quits the app. So the calculator app is one example.
Exactly. And that distinction is really important because you could create categories for iOS apps as well. In fact, when you create a new iOS app in Xcode, there are all these templates, right? Like, do you want a single view application or do you want a tabbed application? But those don't really have the same amount of architectural differences as Mac apps do, where Like you also mentioned, if you have a document-based app, the whole app like is kind of centered around those documents. So the document really becomes like what is driving the entire application. And when you come to like the technical level and the classes that you use, you even have things like the document can create a window controller, and then the window controller has the window, and that can have a view controller, etc. So it really can, it really starts from the document in that case.
Yeah, in a document-based AppKit application, your document class, which will inherit from NSDocument, it's almost like it's a coordinator on the coordinator pattern. So it is like this thing that manages your whole UI and saving the document and reading from the file system. For instance, in FusionCast, I have a document subclass of NSDocument, and it creates the window controller that has the UI inside of it. And everything that's done to that document goes through this document class. So it's pretty much like a coordinator. Like my UI, it doesn't modify the document model directly. It only calls into the document itself. So we talked about window controllers. That's also a difference in AppKit. In AppKit, you have NS window controller, and you also have NS view controller. So the NS window controller is kind of like a view controller, but instead of managing a view, it's managing a window. And windows on the Mac, they are not subclasses of NS view like they are on UIKit, where a UI window is similar. It's a just another UI view. It has some special stuff about it, but it's basically just a UI view. So that's different also on the Mac. So you're usually going to be using your window controller as kind of like a coordinator or a flow controller, depending on what type of architecture you're using, but also to manage your window, like keep track of the window position or setting up your window in the first place if you want to like customize the type of window you want. So that's the job of the window controller.
Exactly. And when you're faced with this kind of situation where, let's say you're coming from an iOS background and you see all these different classes, like you have an NS document, you have a window controller, window, view controller, view, it can feel a little bit overwhelming, and it can be tempting to say, well, let me just do what I'm used to and just write my apps with view controllers as kind of the center of the universe, right? Mm-hmm. Where the view controllers on iOS are what kind of drives a lot of the events and the system logic and things like that, because that's kind of how the SDK is designed. But on the Mac, that's not the case. Those things are more kind of spread out over these different classes. But I would really, really recommend to lean into the Mac way of doing things, if you will, like to try to not just write an iOS app, but using AppKit, but to rather like lean into the conventions. And there's a couple of important reasons for that. The first is that since AppKit is pretty old, or, you know, pretty old at this point, very old at this point by kind of technology standards, especially if you compare it to something like SwiftUI or UIKit, right? It has so many features, like it has so much built in. And it's amazing when you start, like, just go to Xcode and as a fun exercise, create a new Mac app, a document-based Mac app, and you just run it. Like, you didn't write any code. You can do, like you said, you can do Command N, you can save your document, you can open it, you can close it, you can create a new one. Like, there's so many things you can do just out of the box because the system does it all for you. And if you lean into all of those conventions and try to use them, you know, use the APIs as documented and use all of those kind of objects and their different roles in the application, then you will just get so many behaviors and so much functionality for free.
Absolutely. And another tip is, as our listeners will know, I don't really use storyboards on iOS, but I strongly suggest using Interface Builder for Mac apps, because there are some subtle things about some controls and the way windows are set up and things like that, that if you, especially if you're just getting started and you're trying to do everything in code, you're going to have a bit of trouble with it. So I suggest starting out with Interface Builder. even if you don't like it, try using it. If you want to write your UIs in code, I'd suggest structuring your like window and your main menu in IB and using code just for like the inner parts of your view controllers, because then you get a lot for free. So that's a quirk about Mac app development that some people might not know about, and they're getting started, and then they delete main.storyboard from their Mac app, and then they wonder where their main menu went.
Right, exactly. And building a main menu as just an example in code, I don't even know. It's probably possible, but it's not nice.
Yeah, it's definitely possible.
Right, it's not really designed to be that way, like to be used that way. It's really designed to be used visually. And I do the same thing. I use Interface Builder. I don't use Storyboard so much, but I build my view controllers and my windows with zip files, like with Interface Builder files attached to them when I build a Mac app, unless I'm using SwiftUI, of course.
Yeah, definitely. And these days you can use Storyboard references and things like that, which make it a lot more manageable. So like for the preferences stuff in AirBuddy, like I do everything in code for the main status window UI, the UI on the status bar icon that's not in V1, but it's going to be in V2. So I do a lot of UI in code for AirBuddy, but my preferences window, which is like basically a bunch of checkboxes and dropdowns and buttons, that's all in IB, and I have a big tab bar controller. And every separate section of that tab bar controller is a separate storyboard using storyboard references.
Right. And another thing that makes Interface Builder or Storyboard so powerful on the Mac is the same thing there, that there's so much history. There's just the API is so incredibly rich, and there are so many different controls. So almost any app that you can find on the Mac, unless it's like a game or something, like you can recreate its UI. Like I'm looking at Pages here right now, and I could probably recreate the whole UI of Pages in a Storyboard or in an Interface Builder file just using the built-in components, because there are so many of them.
Yeah, that's also another thing that's interesting about Mac apps, is that they tend to use standard controls a lot more than on iOS. The standard UI controls in UIKit, they're kind of bland. It's not that they're bad, like they work very well and they have a pretty design, but it's very common on iOS apps to style UI components in your own way. But on the Mac, that's not usually the case. It's way more common for apps to just use the standard controls.
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely more of a stronger design language, if you will, from the platform. So yeah, when you do something custom on the Mac, it can sometimes even be tricky to get it right and to feel really native, because the design language is so much stronger. Like on iOS, I'm not going to say it doesn't have a design language, because it does, but it's more like a direction, if you will. Like it's more like, yeah, you know, we use this kind of quote unquote flat design with not a lot of texturing and things like that, like fonts and colors and shapes. But that's it. On the Mac, there's all these like buttons and behaviors and different, like look at Xcode, for example. There are all these like tree views and table views and things like that, that users have certain expectations around how they would work. And recreating those behaviors is really difficult. So using standard controls is usually the way to go on the Mac.
Yeah, especially because behaviors on the Mac, they can be customized a lot more than on iOS from the user's perspective. So you might have users who have a full keyboard access on, so you're going to have focus rings around your UI controls so people can tab around. And if you're implementing a custom control and it doesn't respect that, the user is going to feel like your app is broken. You can have users who are using a mouse that's not like the magic mouse, it has like a physical scroll wheel, and so they have the scroll bar is always visible, so that's going to change the layouts of views that have scroll bars, such as text views and table views. So there's a lot of customization that can be done at the system level on the Mac, where if your app doesn't respect those customizations, it's going to feel broken. And that's why people really like to hate on Electron apps and things like that. It's because mainly because of these little things that they don't do the way the Mac is expected to do.
Exactly. So another thing I'd like to talk about here is events. So we talked about the responder chain last week, and that's of course one way of propagating events. But in general, I would say that the way that UIKit propagates different events and the way you can observe them is quite different from how things usually work in AppKit. So in UIKit, you usually either have like a delegate API or a closure-based API, and you create something like a button or a text field or whatever it might be, and they're usually a subclass of UI control, and then you can like add target action, or you can attach a closure, or you can assign yourself as a delegate. But on the Mac, you have those patterns too, but there are also more patterns that you might not first expect. So something that is very common to stumble upon is something that's very common, which is you have a text field and you want to observe the text value of the text field. On iOS, you would do that by using the target action pattern. So you would assign yourself as the target or your class as the target, and then you with the action that the value was changed. But on the Mac, you instead use notification center to get that notification, and you add the text field as the object you want to observe in the notification center, and then you get the notification for when the text has changed. So those are some things to kind of keep a lookout for, is that if it at first doesn't seem like you can do something, which is common, it's usually just that you have to look at another place or look at the documentation where it will say that you need to use like a different kind of pattern that you might not be used to get that event.
Yeah, absolutely. One big difference, like you mentioned, is in UIKit's controls, they have this add target action for control event method. So you can add a target and an action that's going to be triggered when a specific event happens in the control, such as value changed or editing changed for text fields. But on the Mac, you usually just have a property called target and another one called action, and that's it.
Right, exactly. So, yeah.
And some controls, they have like sends event on or something like that, where you actually tell it like, I want you to send me this event when this happens, but it's a binary thing. Like you choose that specific option and that's it. You can't add others. so you need to be aware of that. It's also way more common in AppKit for you to subclass things in order to hook into what you want to hook into, such as some scrolling events in your NS scroll view and things like that. NS scroll view, last time I checked, didn't even have a delegate thing. So yeah, it's a little bit different.
Speaking of scroll views, which is very different compared to iOS and the Mac, is kind of how you compose views together. So in iOS, for example, when you have a UI text view, that automatically scrolls when the text overflows. But on the Mac, you will put your text view inside of a scroll view to get that same behavior.
Yeah, and the way you do that is not by calling add subview on the scroll view, is by setting your text view as the document view of the scroll view. So
exactly.
It's it is quite different. Also worth mentioning that the coordinate space is flipped on the y-axis.
Exactly. Which at first might seem really strange, right? Like if you're used to the top left being the origin of the coordinate system and on the Mac is the bottom left, that might just seem really strange. But I must say, like, once you get used to that and you can kind of jump back and forth between iOS and the Mac, and you get used to like flipping that switch in your brain, it makes a lot of sense, because the ways that UIs kind of get built up is a lot like from the bottom up, like in terms of their layout, while on iOS it's more kind of from the top down.
I still confuse myself all the time when switching between the Mac and iOS.
Well, I do too sometimes. I'm not going to say that I can just automatically switch completely.
Yeah, it's worth mentioning that there is a property on NS View called isFlipped.
So yeah, that's the best property name. I just always imagine someone flipping a table.
Yeah, so you can return true from that, and then it's going to have the same coordinate system as a UI kit view. Also very common in AppKit is event tracking loops. So gesture recognizers, there are gesture recognizers on AppKit, but depending on the type of gesture or event you want to track, you're going to use a event tracking loop, such as for implementing some custom dragging interaction in a specific part of your app. We're going to leave a link in the show notes. In my WWDC app, there's an example of this in the timeline view where you can pick up a bookmark that's this little dot in the timeline and you can drag it around. And that's implemented in the mouse down callback in the timeline view, but it then starts an event tracking loop for the left mouse up, left mouse dragged, and key up events so that it keeps tracking those events until something happens. So it's quite a bit of code. You're going to see it. I'm not particularly proud of it, but it works.
Nice. And that's just a few examples of differences. And of course, there are many more that we didn't cover here today, but I think we could just round off this topic by just talking a little bit about, given all these differences and given that there is Catalyst, there is SwiftUI, which kind of provide an easier way, if you will, to create a Mac app, especially if you have an existing iOS code base. Why do you think, Rambo, that people should still care or learn more about AppKit?
Well, there are certainly some things that can't be done with Catalyst, especially with Catalyst. But even if you're using SwiftUI, which will translate to native AppKit views at runtime, there are still things that don't exist in SwiftUI. So for those, you're going to have to wrap NS views. I used for a project of mine a custom text view component that was implemented using NS text view for SwiftUI. So you do have to know a little bit of AppKit if you're going to use SwiftUI. If you use just SwiftUI without using any AppKit, you're probably going to struggle with some things. But I'd say if you, like I mentioned at the beginning, if you are an iOS developer and your goal is to bring your iOS app to the Mac, then I'd say just go with Catalyst. Unless you want to do like something super different on the Mac, that's not possible with Catalyst. But even then, I would maybe use Catalyst for the main app and use an AppKit bundle, which is something you can do to implement some native AppKit stuff in your Catalyst app. And we're also going to leave a link in the show notes to a series of posts by Steve Troughton-Smith, where he talks about using this technique of loading an AppKit bundle inside your Catalyst app.
Right. That's really nice. I think in general, like my take on this is that if you're going to write an app for the Mac, it's really, really a big advantage to get to know the native framework of the platform. And even though, yes, SwiftUI does generate native code and Catalyst also, like everything runs natively, but AppKit is still the primary native framework on the Mac. And it will probably be that way for quite a while, even though I'm sure that SwiftUI will gain a lot of new features this year at WWDC, and I'm sure Catalyst will keep expanding. It just spending a day or two just like to familiarize yourself with AppKit, even if you're not going to use it primarily, I think will just speed things up so much, because there are situations when you're using SwiftUI where there is no native view for the thing you want to do. And being able to just quickly bring in an AppKit view in there and to kind of know how it works a little bit can just speed things up so much and just remove a lot of frustration, where AppKit no longer becomes this like scary thing that is old and you should just avoid it. It just becomes another part of your application. And that's really what I would encourage people to do, is to, if you're going to write some kind of Mac utility or software or bring over your app from iOS, I think it's just a big advantage to just spend a little bit of time with AppKit, because if you approach it with a fresh pair of eyes and you don't just assume that it will be exactly like UIKit, but you know that there will be differences, there is a lot of elegant, beautiful patterns in AppKit and a lot of things that can be appreciated. And also, like we mentioned earlier, a lot of powerful things that come with so much for free that you can get an insane amount of work done very, very quickly once you kind of get used to those patterns.
Yeah, exactly. And any work you do on like the core animation side of things, it's pretty much the same. If you have like a UI view that you implemented in terms of CA layers, you can probably just copy the code over and it will work on the Mac with that is flipped property on.
right.
And there's something that something cool about CA layers on the Mac is that on the Mac, CA layers have an auto-resizing mask property. So you can have CA layers auto-resize, which you can't on iOS, which is a bummer. Like that would be super handy.
Yeah, that's true. All right, so that was a really fun deep dive. Hope you enjoyed this one. And let us know also if you have any suggestions for future deep dives that you would like us to do. We, of course, have a long list of things, but it's always nice to hear your suggestions. And speaking of your suggestions, let's go ahead and answer an Ask Stacktrace question. So that's another thing you can do to influence the content of the show is to simply tweet with the hashtag Ask Stacktrace any question that you have, and we'll try to answer it on a future episode. And someone who has done that this week is Nicholas. And Nicholas says that over time, I built up a collection of tools that I like to have within every project that I do, especially when I'm in the prototyping phase. So Nicholas asks, if we do that as well, do we also have a lot of like collection of utilities and things that we like to bring into every project? And if so, how do we bring them in? So what about you, Rambo?
Absolutely. Yeah, I do. I have a lot of like little functions and extensions and things, but I never took the time to actually like make them into a framework or library or Swift package. And I'm not sure if that's worth it. I think it depends on the complexity of what it is, but from the question, it looks like it's talking about simpler things. So I have, like, for instance, I'm even opening an Xcode project here because I can see it. I have this UI view controller plus child extension that has a method in UI view controller called install, and you pass it a UI view controller, and it puts that as a children with the view filling up the whole space with the right constraints and things like that. So I have this in pretty much every UI kit project I have. I have my fluid timing curve, which is a composed animation curve, which uses springs and ease in out. You can check out my talk at BA Swiftable about this. And I have many other like little, I have a function to rubber band a value for animations and things like that. So what I do is I just pick the file from a previous project and I drag it into the new one. And it's usually within a framework. So I think the fluid timing curve comes from Chibi Studio. So it's probably in a cuteness car or something. And then I drag it into my whatever UI framework it is on my other project. So that's how I do it. I basically just drag those files over. And if you look at the different versions of these files in different projects, you're going to see that for some of them, I have made changes to the actual implementations because there was some detail about that particular usage in that project that required a change. And if this was like a shared library or framework, then I would have to think about this breaking all of my other projects. And that's just, in my opinion, not worth it for simple, small, tiny extensions like this.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. And I think that's something that we should always consider when we are thinking about sharing something between projects. Because sometimes the idea of sharing code can get a little bit glorified, if you will, right? Yeah. Like it's this beautiful thing where you have this like code reuse everywhere, no copy and paste anywhere, and it's so beautiful. And it is beautiful, it is elegant. But like you say, it also comes with a cost, which is especially if you're sharing it among a larger amount of projects, chances are that each of those projects will require a slightly different version or slightly different tweaks, especially if you're talking about things like UI and animations. And it can get really difficult to share the exact same implementation without lots of if statements and configurations. And then you just end up becoming like a really complex piece of machinery, which probably isn't worth it, right? And the other opposite of that would be to say, well, one thing I did early in my kind of Swift journey, if you will, was that I created a Swift kit Like, I created a framework that was just like a bunch of extensions on top of Swift that I wanted to use in all my projects. The problem with such a library, and I've seen different companies use similar libraries, which is like a extensions library or something, it is very, very likely that that will become what I like to call a code dumping ground, mm-hmm. which means that since there is no boundaries as to what that will do, you will just put anything in there and it will just keep growing and growing and growing. And over time, you started with this really lean, nice framework, which had like, you know, utilities for adding view controllers or animation utilities or like things you really, really are general purpose and you would need them in every project. But all of a sudden it has like database things in there and file things and networking and all sorts of specialized things in this one big, huge framework.
And then you end up with an NS user activity.
Exactly. Then you re-implement it NS user activity. And that's not something that I think is a good idea either. So copy and pasting code is sometimes the right option. And extracting different things out into a separate library can also be a great option. And I've done that with a few different things. I have, for example, a library called Identity, which is a framework for creating type-safe identifiers and type-safe identifiable types. That's like a super simple library. I don't remember the exact line count, but it's something like 100 lines. And it's a simple framework. It's a standalone framework that I can bring in to any of my projects. And that I reuse across most of my projects. And I have things like Code Extended, which is like extensions to Codable. Same thing there. I can just bring it in as a Swift package and I don't really need to modify it or anything like that. I just use it as it is and it just works. But for more specialized things, and especially when we're talking about the UI layer, I just do the same thing as you, Rambo. Copy and paste and modify whenever I need to.
Yeah. I actually just search using Spotlight usually and I take the first result. It's a very good coding practice.
That's a great coding practice. There should be like an app for that. Like, have I done this before? You can just, you know, put in something and it just, yes, you have done it before. Here it is.
Yeah.
All right. So I think that's a great note to end this episode on. So thank you so much for listening, everybody. And thanks a lot also to our sponsors, Xero SSL and Concepts. Feel free to check them out if you want to help support our show. And also remember, if you want to share anything about Stacktrace, like a link to an episode, your favorite episode maybe, your favorite segment of an episode, with the hashtag #ShareStackTrace. And we'll pick a winner over the next few weeks and invite them to a 1-hour mentorship session. I think that's going to be a lot of fun. But that's it for this episode. So say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye. The only thing that bothers me about your whole setup is that you're still using Apache.
Yeah, you know, it's the same reason I use PHP. It's I know it so well. Like, it's for me, like, these things are so uninteresting. They're just so incredibly boring. Like, I just doesn't appeal to me at all. I just want to get the work done, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, so. We had some meetings with the infrastructure people at the Jobby Job, and I was like, yeah, I almost slept during the meeting. It's so boring.
It can be fun to talk about infrastructure in terms of like architecture and like I like thinking about like networks and these kind of things and this type of thing we were discussing now, that's interesting. But actually, like, writing the, you know, server configuration code, and now that's like, write this configuration file, push to the repo. Oh, no, it failed. Try again. Oh, it failed again. You know, this is so incredibly frustrating for me, this kind of workflow. Yeah. And it's the same thing with this Apache and server configurations. You, like, try one thing, restart server. Oh, no, it failed. I'll start again, you know? So, nah, not going to do that.
How do you call it? Apache?
Apache? Apache. Apache. It's like a Japanese version.
Apache this.